Listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that, like the economy, is only growing at 0.2% over the last 3 months. Frankly, it's all down to this man, Andrew Rampage. How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, but if we do it on a per host basis, it's probably negative.
Actually, it may well be, although we haven't got any extra hosts, so that kind of falls down at that point.
Okay, yeah.
If we had more hosts, though, if our hosts had grown as fast as the Australian population, then yes, the podcast would be a negative per capita host territory. Tell you what, we started on a tangent. How are you, mate? How's your week been?
Yeah, very good. Little bit glad to have sort of the earnings season behind us. A bit of time to sort of breathe and reflect a little bit more. But otherwise, yeah, pretty good. How are you?
I'm very, very well. I'm going to, again, go completely off the agenda and just ask, you mentioned reflecting on earnings season. Anything kind of jumped out at you from earnings season that maybe you've kind of, over the last week, as you've sat back in your rocking chair and smoked your cigar and drank your cognac and ruminated on the world, anything that's kind of come up in terms of kind of reflections or observations from the last month?
I was going to say there was some really, I mean, there are always, you know, bigger moves with earnings results and new information that the market has to digest and then sort of reprice. It's sort of normal around earnings season. Mm. But we saw some really big moves in this earnings season. But then I caught myself and thought, actually, I remember having this conversation with you last year. So I don't know if this is just more of a new normal where markets are.
Yeah.
Or if this is just the last couple of years, the market's just been out of whack with reality and earnings have regrounded it or I don't know. Like, you know, what was some of the big ones from some of the bigger companies was like Domino's.
Yeah.
That was an interesting one. Oh, we've had some big takeovers as well. Altium, like it's been billion-dollar plus companies moving, you know, double-digit percentage amounts is always interesting. I'm kind of more used to that in small caps and micro caps,
right.
But at the other end of town. But then again, I don't know. Am I wrong to call that out as unusual?
I love that question, Matt. I think it's more. You know, turns out we're old, right? And so, you know, I still blanch and pay more than $4 for a schooner at the pub. And I know, because it's just like, in my head, I'm still 18 for a whole lot of different reasons. And you kind of go, what do you mean it's $9 for a schooner? Hey? And it's just
$9 if you're lucky.
Yeah, well, there's that too. Happy hour, mate. So, tip for young players. But it's interesting, mate, for that reason. I think that's, you know, I think it is the new normal. I think it's been normal for a couple of years, but it's still remarkable because you and I have been around long enough to remember when it wasn't normal and those big swings weren't the kind
of.
Or
did we just not notice them at the time? Or has the memory faded? There is
probably
that aspect of it.
Yeah.
I bet if I went back 15 years, 20 years, then we go, actually, no, oh, that would look, remember the day that this company did that.
That's
where I sort of catch myself. And maybe that's the observation is that we find it surprising.
The more things change, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. More they stay the same. Anyway.
So I think that's right. I mean, for me, I don't know if I've reflected on this last week, and if I have, my apologies, it's a bit of a blur with earnings season, but I think this year's going to be the year of cost cutting. Did I say that last week?
I might have seen you say something on Twitter.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. So if you think about, other than the big movements, the big companies that all had, a lot of them had very, 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 very modest sales growth, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6%. And they had cost growth that generally was more than that, or at least approaching that. And so
if you
kind of think through what that means, and there's no surprise, right? The economy, we'll talk about the economy in a minute, but the economy's not growing. If you're already big, it's very hard to take more market share because you own a large chunk of the category. And back to your point about small caps, by the way, we did talk about the last week of the small businesses like the Flexi Groups and stuff, I think I mentioned last week, that can grow regardless. But if you're a big company, you've kind of got not much left. You say, well, hang on, I can't get sales growth. I can't really take much market share, at least not without dishing my profits in the process. My costs are going up because my cost of goods, my inventory is more expensive, my staff are more expensive, transport distribution is more expensive. You know, maybe you get a couple of dollars off marketing because people aren't marketing as much, and maybe there's some deals to be had. But broadly speaking, almost every line of your P&L is going up. And while your sales are going up, a lot of the sales growth, frankly, this is the other thing for people, is sales growth of 5% used to be, hey, we're selling 5% more stuff. These days, it's, we're probably selling the same number of things. We put our price up a bit to try and get some of those costs back. But then you've got all the other stuff that goes with it. And so that's kind of the, you know, so my observation, I guess, is profit growth is hard to come by. Frankly, we're not, you know, in recession. Again, we'll get to that in a minute. So that's a positive. It's definitely a win. But I do think we're going to see serious amounts of cost cutting. I think this year is going to be the year of unemployment growth, unfortunately, because businesses, shareholders are looking around and going, well, hang on, I need to deliver more profits for my customers or my shareholders, or at least the same. And if I've got costs go up faster than sales, that means profits going down. So how do I try and fix that? And it is going to be the hunt for those costs. And yeah, you can cancel travel, and yeah, you can, you know, cancel a staff Christmas party. After that, the most manageable cost is people. So I suspect that's probably what we'll see, because whether it was Wesfarmers or Woolies, or even Bunnings didn't grow much. Speaking of, you know, one of the best, probably the best retailer in the country. The banks, you know, really, really hard to find growth. We've seen BHP cut jobs, ANZ's cut jobs, a couple others besides. There's a lot going on. So that's probably my biggest observation at a total market.
I mean, I don't like it.
Exactly.
Let me be clear. But that is a really good point. Mm. It's actually, you're talking more of the established companies.
Yes.
I've noticed the same thing in the more growth-oriented
interesting.
Space as well. And where the costs are being, and everyone's talking, you're right, everyone is talking about cost cutting, and where it's coming from. And I'm more for, there's a lot of people in my circle that are extraordinarily cynical about this, and maybe that's not entirely unfair.
Yeah.
But the costs that are being cut was what they call growth capex. Uh-huh. In other words, they were spending money to lay the foundations for future growth. So like we're expecting a lot of orders to come through. I mean, again, put all the conspiracy theories aside. You're running the business. Mm. Things are going well. You've got really good sales momentum. Your staff is having trouble delivering on execution and all that, because they're just stretched too thin because of the demand. You're moving into a new geography, or you've got a new product launch. The R&D teams come up with something. You've got to put infrastructure, like human resources infrastructure, around all of that and the regular stuff besides. And then the growth doesn't come. Or in the case, Alcidion's a good example. We spoke to the CEO at Strawman recently, and it was just sort of like, particularly they do a healthcare software. They deal with the NHS and big health bureaucracies.
Yeah.
And what, you know, ostensibly happened there was the customers just said, oh, we've got a budget freeze, or, you know, we need to, there are procurement delays. We haven't got sign off on this yet. And things just get pushed back into different periods and stuff. And then the market goes, wait, what is that? What, you know, growth has evaporated. What's going on? And it's just it's a very easy thing to be critical of in hindsight. But at the time, there's a different path forward where they didn't make the necessary investment.
Right.
They didn't increase the costs. Competitors ran ahead of them because they were more aggressive in their marketing. You know, they particularly in industries undergoing a structural shift where there is a land grab of sorts in terms of a new way of doing things. Mm. You know, there's only sort of one enterprise grade system a hospital needs. It doesn't have four. So who gets there first wins, kind of thing, and then has more reference sites and tends to get more things. So it's an extremely difficult thing. But back to the original point, it's happening at all kinds of levels.
That's interesting.
And
yeah.
It's why I think, and it's yet another reminder as to why the balance sheet is such an important thing to focus on as an investor, because there are companies out there that even though their sales growth has slowed or even gone backwards a little bit, again, assuming that this is sort of for external reasons, not due to operational failure or reducing relevance or anything like that, but have continued to invest in R&D, have continued to open up the new office in Singapore, have continued to, you know, boost the sales team and the marketing effort when others aren't. And that is an incredible, when the tide turns, as in inexorably will, I don't know when or how, and maybe it gets worse before it does turn, but those companies tend to bolt out of the gates in a much better shape, where everyone is now peeking their head out above the parapet and sort of saying, oh, okay, maybe now we should invest in marketing. It's to the point, particularly in small caps, where some of that, The cost cutting is really forced on you because it kind of gets existential. Not only
is running a loss, right? You've only got so much cash to go, and if you can't bring more cash in either by borrowing or having equity investors throw it at you, you're saying, "Well, I've got this burning platform over here. Literally, the pile of the swimming pool full of cash is getting emptier and emptier, and at some point, it's either empty or we have to start filling it. There's not much option."
Look, when you when your shares are at 20 times sales, you can raise money on the market very cheaply. No problem. Yep. It's like, yeah, we're burning through cash. We're in a growth phase. We're investing for growth. Look at the ROI on the money that we're spending, not the statutory, you know, results over one given period. But then when the market mood changes, as it has dramatically in this space, and you're on much lower multiples, that equity capital is so much more expensive. In other words, you just get so there's so much more dilutive potential for you as an existing shareholder, which is a very extraordinarily real cost, just as inflation is a cost. So, yeah, it's interesting out there. We'll see how it evolves.
It is, mate. I think your point is really important too. And I did tweet about this during the week, actually, that I think cost cutting is really interesting. I want our listeners to think about the second order impact of some of this stuff. There is a general view of Company X sales are falling, therefore they're cutting costs. Shares go up because management's taking decisive action and fixing the P&L. And so profit actually doesn't fall as much as it otherwise might because those costs have been cut. Now, that's first order thinking, right? And it's absolutely 100% accurate and correct. There is, though, a second way to think about this. And this is what I've been on for a bit of time now. It's been a while since the last lot of cost cutting, but same kind of idea is if you have the ability to cut that sort of expense, either, as you say, mate, you're jeopardizing your growth, or you're not jeopardizing your growth and you're cutting expenses you didn't need in the first place, because if you can cut them without impacting growth, guess what? They weren't necessary expenses. They were, you know, frankly, just a mismanaged, undermanaged company.
Great point.
And I don't say that to bag the people who are doing it necessarily, but I actually would want, in a perfect world, this is, again, sounds stupid, but this is second order thinking. I would want to own a company whose profit was more volatile when economic conditions changed, rather than one that wasn't, because they managed to inflate the cost line in the good times and then find cuts in the bad times. In other words, if you're running lean in the good times, you got nothing to cut when things go bad. And that's actually okay, because you've made all that money when things are good. And what it does mean is you'll have more profits in the good times and less profits in the bad times. So you will have a more volatile profit line. And a lot of investors will say, I don't want that. I want smooth earnings. So, well, be careful what you wish for, because I can pad earnings if you want. I can drag down earnings in the good years by having too many staff and too many staff parties and fancy buildings and whatever. So I can waste your money doing that. And then I can get rid of all those things when things get tough, and I can, quotes, save you money. And you think I'm a genius because I've cut costs and avoided profit falling. Net, over the cycle, that second case of the mismanaged company is going to cost you more as a shareholder than the volatile profits in the first place. Now, again, that feels weird, and there'll be people uncomfortable because we feel more comfortable if things are flat and steady, and or like it just feels better. But at total value for the shareholder, total value of the company, you are much better off having a lean company in the good times and a lean company in the bad times, where profit is more volatile, than a fat company in the good times and a lean company in the bad times, because you just simply make less money.
And it's also, again, to be selfish about it all, it's not a bad thing that happens. And this is where you can have an edge as an investor, is to have that longer lens on things. If you can accurately diagnose that any issues are temporary in nature and external in nature and part of what you would otherwise expect to be the normal vicissitudes of operating any business in a complex global economy, they're always going to be challenges and setbacks, no matter who you kind of are. If you can determine that, and the market's all, you know, in a huge funk and selling, giving you a 20% discount because for this thing that you hope to own for 10 years, it just turns out that the last 3 months were pretty sucky. It's a good opportunity. It's also a massive risk for people like me who like to sort of reach for hope more often than they should, which is when the problems are more business specific than my management lead on, which they always will. No management team is ever going to put their hand up and say, yeah, we've just completely cocked this up. This is ridiculous. No, it's like, oh, it's a very tough industry out there. Interest rates are high. You know, there'll be any true. Number that's of sort true. Of reasons to do it.
We're so, geniuses when things go well, and it's their fault when things go badly.
So it's very easy for me to say, and it's the right thing to sort of say to remind people that, there is opportunity in this, but there is also great risk. What I say is only accurate if you've got some reasonable basis to believe that these are shorter term issues. If they're not, you can find yourself averaging all the way to zero.
I almost think I heard you say, "With great power comes great responsibility." Then I'm not sure if you meant that or not, but it's very, very no. Spider-Man of you. Very, very Peter
Uncle
Parker.
Ben.
Very Uncle Ben. Yeah. Exactly. Mate, yeah, fascinating season reflections. Let's move on to the big news of this week, mate, which was the GDP, the gross domestic product numbers that were out. Now, for those who don't know, most people will, gross domestic product is the bean counter's best guess of the total economic output over a period. So all the things that we do and make and sell and everything that we kind of we exchange money for effectively kind of gets rolled up together. And they say, over the last 3 months, this is how much stuff we did. This is the value of the things that we did. And we compare that against this time last year and say, are we doing more things than this time a year ago? And generally speaking, you know, GDP is a funny one, mate. Again, we're a finance podcast, but we're not a bean counters podcast, and we're not a blindly ideological podcast. GDP is a measure of national improvement. It's a pretty blunt, ugly, ineffectual one when it comes to anything else. It doesn't measure well-being, doesn't measure happiness. And as we've said before, mate, if a building falls down, repairing it adds to GDP. If it stays standing, there's no GDP addition. And you can't say, well, hang on, which one's better? So, you know, there are some really significant shortcomings. That being said, it's almost the best option we've got, at least for now, of a way to measure the economic story. So a couple of things, I suppose. Let's start with a headline. I'll get to the per capita numbers in a minute. 0.2% was the quarterly growth for the months of October, November, and December 2023. That was positive. I will say, mate, Treasurer Chalmers was out last week, kind of saying, well, things might be weak, things might be tough. And it did occur to me that maybe Treasury was trying to hose down expectations. They might have said whispered in the Treasurer's ear, mate, this could be negative. Just be careful here. You might want to kind of let people know, just soften them up. So I got to say, I was a little bit nervous that it might have been a negative number, which, again, is not that big a deal, except a couple in a row we have the headlines with the capital R recession splash all over it. That has its own issues and impacts on the economy. So 0.2% for the quarter, that's 1.5% for the last 12 months. That is the lowest, outside the worst of the COVID pandemic, since the year 2000. Now, I say outside COVID, so it's only the worst for a few years. That being said, it's as bad as it's been outside COVID since 2000, so 24 years. Many of our listeners wouldn't have been working for that long. Some, the ones I hate most, weren't even alive that long. They're not used to this sort of circumstance. By the way, that 0.2%, 0.6% of that came from net exports. So next time you hear someone complain about globalization and trade and all that kind of stuff, just remember that we sent more stuff overseas than we bought from overseas. If we hadn't done that, we actually would have had a negative quarter of GDP growth. So, I get people want to sort of make trade and globalization the bad guy. And again, like GDP, there are some rough edges and stuff, but you want to be a little bit careful.
Yeah.
What do you make of the numbers?
I mean, as you say, they're the best guess. And so I tend to look more directionally and more generally at it. So, I mean, whether it was 0.1, 0.2, yes, exactly. Or 0 or negative 0.1,
yes.
It's not great.
Very flat. Right? it's an estimate, by the way, too. So you kind of, I mean, they're big numbers, so they're going to get it roughly right. The margin of error is probably not that big. But, yeah, add all that stuff together, as you say, it's like, well, that's pretty flat no matter which language you want to use.
Yeah. And I look, it is a rough measure, and for me, it's an only sensible way of looking at it is per capita. I mean, I don't know how you don't look at it per capita. We will and have many times on this podcast talked about the difference between a company's profit and its earnings per share.
Yes.
Well, why? Why would we? I mean, there are plenty of companies whose profits go, you know, up and to the right, where the earnings per share goes flat or even down because they're just issuing shares like crazy. There's an inflation effect. There's a dilution effect that's there. And if we're trying to sort of say, I mean, what really matters is not the overall aggregate level of the economy, but what our equal share, well, not equal is not the right word, but what is our per person share of that? It's gone backwards. So I'm not trying to just, because people will think, well, there goes Andrew again, always trying to find the glass half empty kind of angle to it.
Except that, well, you know.
Well, you know, even if it was good, I think that is the number that needs to be, I haven't heard a good argument as to why that isn't the main number.
You're 100% right.
Yeah. Remind me of this. I'm embarrassed because I've blanked out here on this, but these GDP numbers take into account inflation, or do they not take into account inflation?
They are.
In other words,
go on.
Well, if it doesn't take inflation into account, then that growth is a growth in prices only and not in volume of goods sort of transacted, right? I always forget this one. I know they break it out and there's like 1,000 different flavors. So I don't know. I don't know if the headline number that's been reported is inflation adjusted, but that's an interesting point if it is, right? Given even though it's come down, it would still sort of say, well, on a per capita basis and in terms of trying to measure the amount of activity, not just the price levels of things, you know, it's not super encouraging.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you know?
No. So I believe it's chain volume. So I believe it's not. I think it's adjusted for inflation, but I don't know for sure. I don't want to mislead.
It should be.
Yes. But again, I don't want to say. So there's probably a lot of people yelling at the pod machine right now, saying, "No, you idiots, this or it's that or whatever." So I'm not entirely sure.
But directionally, right? It's going the wrong direction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm literally trying to look it up now because. Yes, no, it is. It is. It's adjusted for inflation, mate. So in nominal terms, GDP was higher than in real terms. Yes, I'm glad I was right about that one because I was a bit nervous for that for a second. There. You know, one of those things you think you know, and then you go, "I think I know that."
I don't know that. I better blanket that one. Yeah,
exactly. So, mate, look, I think that, and look, I want to double down on your per capita point. So, if you are a business, you don't care about per capita because you want more people to buy more stuff, right? You want, if you're selling baked beans, you don't care how many people you sell the baked beans, so you just want to sell more baked beans. And so it's irrelevant. If you are collecting taxes at some level, the collection alone, you don't care. However, if you're paying for infrastructure, you care a lot because the amount of infrastructure you need depends on how many people you've got. And to your point about GDP, and this is why I said it's not perfect, but again, this is the current GDP should be written as, hey everyone, the pie is getting bigger, but unfortunately you're all getting smaller slices. That's and we use pizza all the time. That is fundamentally that what the headline should say. Now, it doesn't, and maybe it's in no one's interest. Maybe it was never thought about. Maybe for most of the time, it wasn't a problem because population wasn't growing so quickly, and you know those things are important. And there are benefits from population growth. We've talked about this a lot over the last little while, but. It is. So again, speaking of Twitter, I feel like we're doing a Twitter summary this week, but I wrote on Twitter again the other day, you know, for all of, I'm not sure the pollies did this deliberately, but the best trick they ever pulled was to only talk about GDP rather than GDP per capita. Because it's just, you know, imagine if you had four more people move into your house and your house went up by 20% in price. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, my house is more expensive. Yeah, but you've got to share it with more people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I get more. It's like it makes no sense. It absolutely makes no sense to not do per capita numbers, and particularly at a time when the population is growing faster than the output. In other words, we are in a per capita recession. Mm-hmm. The simple reality is that we are producing less per person than we were. Now, I mentioned the GDP limitations. We don't get a share of GDP. No one sends us a check and say here's your bit. And so distribution matters a lot. Even if it's growing, it doesn't mean everyone necessarily is getting their share of it. And it can be declining, and I can get more than you can get. So individually, there's no evening out of the way it works. But fundamentally, if you're saying, are we a richer, more prosperous, more successful nation per person, which is what we should be doing, that's kind of all that matters. It makes no sense that we pretend the total is what matters. I mean, you can be cynical and you can say, well, the total number is likely to grow because of population. So, of course, the policy is going to focus on it. You can say that business loves, by the way, we're investors, business loves more population growth because they get more people to sell to. So, of course, they care about the total GDP. As shareholders, we might care more about total GDP because, again, it means there are more people spending more money and there's only one Woolworth still. So they probably get a larger share of that and they're pretty happy. And I don't own Woolies shares, but I do it for Harvey Norman, which I do own, or anything else. And as investors, if we divide our brains up, you know, I'm happy to sell more fridges and TVs and couches to people, sure. Mm. But at a national level, at an economic level, if you're in charge of the economic policy, not just the spoils of capitalism policy, then it's a real issue. We should be talking about GDP. It's the only thing we should be talking about. The total does not matter to anybody else other than the shareholders, and there's plenty of us, so that's cool. But the headline should absolutely always be about GDP per capita because that's the thing that matters.
Yep. And secondarily to that, the distribution of it as well. And this is where you can take whatever angle you like with these headline numbers. You sort of get into the weeds. And as you sort of say, there's sort of a big boost from exports and there's a big contraction elsewhere. I think that can give you, a bit more of a flavor of the data. So Chalmers himself noted that the weakness, a lot of it was from discretionary spending. So it was like a 0.1% rise in household spending over the quarter, and that was driven entirely by essentials. So, electricity, rent, food, health, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Things like hotels, cafes, restaurants, new vehicles, clothing, footwear, not going well. Yeah. And so, again, here's me doing the doom and gloom, but that does not strike me as an economy where people are feeling really happy and confident and splurging on themselves. And remember, everyone's spending is someone else's income. So it all sort of has an effect. The other thing that Chalmers noted, which is interesting and I think very worthwhile remembering, given that export factoid that you just mentioned, a quarter of G20 nations have recorded a technical recession or narrowly avoided one.
Yeah.
China's now out saying that they're expecting, growth to moderate. Fancy way of saying, we're past. Aren't looking as good as they were.
As they were, yeah.
I mean, it matters a lot. It matters a lot to Australia. They're our biggest export partner, right? So where do you think all those exports are sort of going? So all of that is just to sort of say we don't live in a vacuum. And when the world is doing it tough, we're inevitably going to do it tougher. The old saying used to be when the US sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold.
That's right.
Might be so when China sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold as well, or Trimerica, as Neil Ferguson would call it. is just, I guess, and the talk is always, the so what at the end of this is always about, okay, so what are rates going to do now? Mm-hmm. And whether it's in the US or here, everyone's on the, okay, so this is it. Rates are peaked. When do we go down is the only conversation. It's not if we're going to go down, but when are we going to go down and by how much. And maybe that's proves to be the correct sort of forecast. But again, it's not something that you see in a super healthy economy where, like, again, if we're doing great, interest rates aren't being cut. So yeah, we'll want to see a pickup in things.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to get it, mate. I've got to say, I don't do predictions, but I would suspect we bump along the bottom for a while, which, by the way, is still a really, really, really good result. Given where we are, given where we've been, 18 months ago, if you'd said inflation's 8%, how happy would you be if we grew at 0.2% rather than being in recession? So I'd take it. Now, again, we're already in a per capita recession, so it's not whether it's a... Well, actually, so here's the quick tangent. Recessions matter a lot for reasons that they shouldn't matter. And they matter a lot because it's self-fulfilling prophecy. They're the things we talk about. Mm-hmm. So what we've been trained, I don't even think deliberately, over the last 40 plus years to know and believe and to understand is recessions are bad. Recessions are when the economy sucks and people lose jobs and people stop spending and businesses close. And so recessions are to be avoided at all costs. That's what we've been taught and or absorbed for ourselves. I claim no grand conspiracy here. It's just the general conversation. So when you know and see that, as soon as there's a big R headline in the papers, we will snap our wallets and purses shut. People will go to ground. They will fear losing their jobs. They will make sure that they hoard some money, all that kind of stuff. And it will actually make those things worse rather than better. Just as, by the way, booms do exactly the same thing. The economy's flying. Everyone's great. Oh, good. I'll go on that holiday then. We react to the, this is investing 101 too. We react to the short term. We react to things happening right now. And the capital R recession, I use that term only because it's the one that gets written up in the paper, and it's not the per capita one that no one's talking about. The per capita recession is fine, but when we get a capital R recession, everyone says, oh, the country's stuff, look, it's a recession. That will have a rarely significant impact on confidence, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's kind of why, for all of the things I ranted about per capita recessions, while ever the total economy recession is the hot topic, the buzzword, the tipping point, effectively the inflection point. That's why I think it's so important we stay out of it. Not because, as you say, there's a difference between plus 0.1 and minus 0.1. It's the same number, except that, and we saw this during the GFC, the Wayne Swan, Kevin Rudd cash splash, and the economy declined the first quarter, I think, and then grew up plus 0.1% the second quarter. Now, effectively, it could have been minus 0.1, plus 0.1. The fact we, quote, avoided recession is still talked about today. And when people say, oh, the rest of the world had a recession, we didn't have a recession, and we got out of this better and all that kind of stuff, it's partly mining. It's partly other things, but to my mind, and I think it's reasonably well accepted, the confidence impact of, oh, thank God we avoided it, we can go back to business as usual, was a really significant impact in what avoiding what otherwise might have happened, which is probably businesses not hiring, consumers shutting their wallets, and a longer drawn out economic decline because of the very fact we heard we were in recession, so we acted accordingly, rather than the reverse, which is we acted a certain way, so we went into recession in the first place.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think you're broadly right. One thing I do think, though, is that we all live in our own bubble and we all act with self-interest, you know, just to call it for what it is. So there is also a very much an organic sort of component to all of that, where the impact, the psychological impact you're speaking about, I think is meaningful to people who are on the edge. If my business is flying and I've got $1 million in cash just sitting in the bank, I mean, I really don't care what the headlines say. I want that. I'm going to buy it. You know, it's as simple as that.
That's absolutely true.
So there is that to it. But speaking of that, we were speaking before about companies that have a significant advantage in having a strong balance sheet during a difficult time. Mm. That's exactly true for the personal balance sheet as well. So your Scott Phillips personal balance sheet will determine how well you endure said periods if and when they do come.
True.
And what you will where just to riff a little bit more on the point you were making before about recessions being conditioned to say that recessions are bad. Right. They are bad. Like anytime human suffering, I'm against human suffering. Let me just put that out there. Exactly. Right? But I think the reality of the world we live in is that, you know, this diabolically complex, dynamic, you know, chaotic system we call the economy is always going to go through periods of ups and downs.
Yeah.
And I've mentioned this before on the pod, my concern is the unintended consequence of trying to get rid of recessions is just to make kick cans down road and make inevitabilities bigger and more worse than they should be. As you said before, if this is as bad as it gets and we just sort of bump along the bottom, that's a pretty good outcome. And generally, if you sort of let failures happen quicker and sooner, they are less painful for everyone involved. Have some people suffered in that? Yes. Can I entirely eliminate human suffering? Well, no, but I'm open to any suggestions that anyone has in terms of ideas on that front. But given we can't, it becomes a choice between what do you want, often and little, or rarely and catastrophic.
Exactly.
And I feel as though that's we keep pushing in that direction for the best of intentions and for the best of reasons, but at some point the system has such a weight on top of it that, you know, I'll make the point again, just look at your own balance sheet and think carefully about that. You want to prudently invest and take advantage for the future, just as a company does. But you want to make sure there's a little bit of resilience there as well.
You know. By the way, too, just the last point on this one, everything you just said is absolutely true, and yet we'll still have a recession because when the economy goes from plus 0.1 to minus 0.1, you don't need that many people to change their behaviours that significantly. And so it actually is the edge that drags us over. And again, it's those people on the edge who do suffer. When unemployment goes from 5 to 10%, only 5% more people lose their jobs. The other 90% of people stay employed. It is, as you say, mate, it's all about those who get smashed from this sort of stuff, because most of us, hopefully you and I included, would keep our jobs in a recession, but plenty of people will lose theirs, and it will be a small percentage. And it's not for a second to suggest it's not important or relevant. It's absolutely super important. They're no more or less valuable than I am or you are. But it's the edges that, you know, the edge cases lose their jobs. The edge cases are where businesses fail or the economy goes from plus 0.1 to minus 0.1 and creates that recession. You don't need much. Man, retail is such a tough game. The margins there are so diabolically small that you only need a small drop in sales with a really high fixed cost base to make otherwise profitable businesses, you know, effectively put them out of business. In fact, we saw Tiger Lily, the swimwear brand, go broke for the second time in 4 years this week. Now, I'm not suggesting it's necessarily, you know, the plural anecdote isn't data, and the plural data isn't necessarily information either. But it's interesting that they went broke again for a second time. We're going to see more of that this year as well, unfortunately.
Yep. And just very quickly, I will say this too. There's huge sympathies for those people that do unfairly lose their job for forces beyond their sort of control and impact. At the same time, to be maybe a little edgy, I have less sympathy, let's put it that way, for those that took very excessive reckless risk is, I mean, there is a consequence to some actions, and there will be, you talk about the people on the edge, on the margin, that sort of bear the brunt of it. There is a whole bunch of people who sort of unfairly get bucketed in that because of the exuberance perhaps of people well above them. And then those that have sort of made their own bed, so to speak. And again, that's kind of a lesson. You don't, otherwise you're just going to have an economy dominated by skases and bonds and, you know, all other corporate kind of villains, which is sort of like, all they really did was just bet massively and aggressively and got lucky and wanted all the upsides that came with that. But now, you know, feel it unfair if the gods of fortune don't smile at them. So
correct.
You know, failure is important in a lot of ways.
It's one of those things, mate. I think that's right. I'm not as absolute as you on that stuff. I think I'm happy for us to try a bit harder to avoid recessions and that kind of thing. But overall, you're absolutely right. It's funny, you know, humans are weird creatures. The base effect is interesting. You know, people say, haven't had this many business failures since period X, whenever that X was. What we don't see the headlines of is, we had so many businesses created in the 5 years since then as well. You know, that idea of, you know, the number of failures is something to do with the not just the circumstances, but the decisions that were made to create those businesses in the first place, or to make those companies. I'm not explaining it particularly well, but you know, if you have 100 more things and 50 of them fail, that's a big deal. You're left with 50. If you have 1,000 more things and 900 of those fail, you're still left with another 100. So which is better? Now, no one wants the failures, but maybe most of the people shouldn't have gone into business in the first place. And we don't say, gee, business failures are up because people did silly things and went into business. We say, business failures are up, therefore there's a problem we must fix. And I think we sometimes look at the downside and say, let's stop the downside, which is kind of your point, rather than either let's accept it and just who cares, or actually let's not let things get so out of control in the first place. And either of those two things, they're very different in terms of the causes or the solutions, but both kind of rely on the same thing, which is starting with where we came from is a much bigger deal than maybe we've gone to.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Now, mate, let's move on to something else this week that I thought was really interesting and probably... Maybe not all that interesting for the inevitability that we probably all assumed, but interesting given what's happening in the economy. And this is the closure of every single Bank West branch. Now, this is a West Australian-based bank. It was bought by CBA during the GFC 15 years ago, basically because it was going to go broke if it wasn't bought by somebody. The ACCC waved it through, APRA waved it through. It was like, well, this is as good as it gets, and it's worse if we don't do something, so you guys can buy it. And that was 15 years ago, and I don't know what intentions CBA may or may not have had at the time. But we come forward now to 2024, a couple of really interesting stats. So firstly, there's 60 branches remaining of Bank West. They're going to close 45 outright and convert 15 of them to CBA branches. So a nice little brand expansion for CBA, I'm sure they'll be very happy about. But also too, the numbers that came out from this announcement, Bank West reckon 97% of transactions are now done digitally or electronically, using the app or using some version of electronic funds transfer, whether it's credit card or just, you know, internet banking or BPAY or whatever. I was flabbergasted by that, I've got to say, mate. I mean, I don't know how reasonably that reflects other banks. I assume Bank West had a digital strategy for a while now. Their branches certainly are more like, lounges rather than the old school bank branches with, you know, bulletproof glass and tellers handing out cash. So they've been cash free for ages, I think, from memory. But I thought it was interesting, mate, for that kind of the decision that CBA basically made. So you know what? The branches don't pay for themselves anymore. We are losing money with these branches. We think the business is more profitable, more successful as an online only player. And I think there's a couple of thoughts I have here, mate. The first is that's just interesting in and of itself. The second is, you know, a lot of the other banks have already got their second brand. They're kind of their online brand. Yeah, there's NAB's got UBank and St. George's got Dragon Direct. And I do wonder whether CBA is kind of looking at this as not only as a bank we're standalone, but as a corporate idea of if we shut this thing down, we could basically reposition the brand as a price fighting, lower price brand, digital only, and use that as our kind of way into the digital banking space, which is continuing to take off. Your thoughts, mate, on the closures, cash, digital banking, the whole box and dice?
I mean, I can see it from two angles. I mean, I get it. It's not making money. I mean, if I ran any business, and 97% of my customers used one sort of route to my business, and there was a tiny percentage that used another one, I'd close the other one. Yeah. It doesn't make... I get it. It's not a nefarious intent that's behind this. It's just pure economic rationality. Oh, and at the same time, I feel mainly for the elderly that are used to sort of doing it in that way. But you got to ask yourself, well, is it up to private enterprise to provide a social good?
Right.
I don't know. Maybe banks are different. Yeah. I actually don't know the answer to that. I saw you say on Twitter, actually, the post office could pick up the slack, you know, and provide banking service. I think it's a really good solution if the government wanted to sort of step in and do something. And again, whether you think they should or shouldn't. I would say this as well. Again, you've made the point. We're not spring chickens anymore. I remember when Facebook was for university students. And then it was for anyone under 25 or 30.
Yeah.
And now you go to Facebook, it's just boomers everywhere, right? Yeah. Everyone else, all the cool kids have gone elsewhere. And you know what? The boomers just adapted to it. And I do think that necessity is the mother of invention. It's not quite the right saying, but granddad will figure it out. When the grandson comes along and says, look, it's not that hard, granddad. Here, press this, then press this, then press this. It's sort of... Yeah, I speaking of old, right? I remember when FPOS, even when ATMs came to my country town.
I do too.
You know, no, I'm not getting money out of the wall. Whatever. And in those days, there was, you know, sometimes you get a mistake. It wouldn't count out the right number of notes, and you'd have to go in. I was just like, it just seems so regular. Yeah. Like you can't. And now they're being phased out. That's how we've gone through a whole adoption and then and then a redundancy sort of cycle. So yeah, look, I have no criticism to CBA whatsoever. Do what you have to do in that instance. Mm-hmm. If we want to have a broader discussion of looking after the access for those that are less technically savvy, that's a perfectly valid conversation to have. And we can decide as a society if we want that as like a social service of some description. But yeah, no harm, no foul for CBA from where I sit.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you're right. Our pharmacy wholesalers are paid to provide a certain level of service, which is drugs literally anywhere in the country, certainly in metros, within 24 hours. Yep. We expect of Telstra a community service obligation to have coverage and that kind of stuff. And I think part of the problem with banks, obviously, is there are so many of them that it's hard to give any individual bank that obligation. Telstra gets paid for obligations that Coptus doesn't have, for example. And the pharmacy wholesalers can choose not to take the money either.
Yep.
They can be paid by the government to do that or simply choose not to do it. But I'm with you, mate. I suspect that as a social service, banking remains important and allowing people. I have friends and family, frankly, who struggle to use internet banking as it is without help. And so I kind of think, and they're lucky. I mean, I was going to say lucky to have me, which sounds a little bit self-serving. But you know, they're lucky to have someone who can help them. I don't know what would happen in those circumstances where those people simply didn't have the facility. Of saying, well, I'm having trouble with this. Can you help me? I say, yeah, sure. Here you go. If I wasn't around, someone else wasn't around, what do you do? And I kind of think, I don't know, mate. I've said many, many, many times, the economy is there to serve the society, not the other way around. I have no problem with the banking sector, who are frankly protected from competition through the Four Pillars policy. They have been allowed to merge and grow. ANZ's taken over Suncorp most recently. Again, in the context of the Bankwest thing, I find that just still really bizarre. But for all those things, I have zero issue saying to banks, hey, you guys are, and you've said many times, you know, they get to create money, right? These guys are a special case. Yeah. I think there is every reason to say, I get it, but guys, you're going to have to do this. I would, to your point about AusPost, what I would actually do is I'd say, right, Australia Post will provide banking services. Every bank in the country must make their systems operable and accessible by Australia Post staff. They must pay Australia Post for the provision of those services. And
yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, for a sunset period.
Yep.
Call it 20 years. I don't know what the right number is, right? I figure anyone who's still working today can use internet banking sufficiently. So we're talking about, and I don't want to blanket anybody, or there's some spectacularly technologically savvy retirees, right? So again, I'm not suggesting they can't, but if you think about those who are most likely to be unable to, they're most likely to be older. Mm. There's probably some questions about vision impaired people. I don't really have a strong handle on that. But I would suspect there's a sunset period over which time you'd say, right, AusPost gets some money from the banks to provide these services that need to be provided in person for as long as they need to be provided. By the way, did you know the number of ATMs has crashed?
Yes, I did.
There's something like, yeah. It's down by some, I can't remember the numbers, it's down by a stupid amount in 5 years, maybe a third, something like that.
I go to one once in a blue moon.
Same.
Once in a blue moon.
I don't remember the last time I took cash out of the bank, actually. No.
I've never been inside a bank for as long as I can remember, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, let's kind of stay with the economy, but talk about housing approvals. We've, speaking of banks and lending and mortgages, we've spoken a lot about the house price issues. And we've talked a lot about both supply and demand. We've talked about population growth and whether you're a big Australia or a small Australia person, the current level of growth is just out of control relative to our ability to house people. That was brought into stark relief, mate, this week when the housing approvals numbers up about as low as they've been in 15 or 12 years, I think it is. Mm. And the trend over the last 12 months is just diabolically low. Mm. That consistent low level we haven't seen since before the GFC, actually, before 2009. It's been a remarkable challenge, and I don't know that I have much more to add, frankly, other than the data, and just to kind of throw my metaphorical hands up in the air and say, I don't really know what the government thinks they're doing. can the federal government change planning rules? No. But the federal government can sure as hell impact population. Can state governments impact population? No. But sure, they can work on planning. It just strikes me that the sheer lack of interest. And yeah, it's about house prices, I suppose, at one level. But it's literally about, it's not just affordability, it's now availability. Mm. There was a Domain report out saying that, I used to say, vacancy rates might be less than 1%, when the numbers were 0.9, because I thought 0.9 is so stupidly low. I'll say low, probably less than 1, because maybe there's some error in the data. The newest numbers out this week, mate, 0.7% is the new vacancy rate. Mm. And regardless of ideology or political persuasion or anything else, this is just maths. This is literally just maths. And for our politicians, whether you're a state, federal, Liberal, Labor, colour thumpy, I don't care, you just look at that and think, this is just... It's just straight out negligent, surely. There can be no other word for it. The PM and the states want to build 1.2 million houses in 5 years. Good luck. We had 12,000 houses approved. That's not even started. That's approved. So then they've got to be started. They've got to be finished. So we're talking about 12 months from now. Then they've got
to be hopefully finished to a reasonable standard.
Right?
Yeah.
And then sold at a reasonable price. And you kind of think, we're 8 months away from whatever's been approved today being available for to live in.
Yeah.
And you look at the five-year plan and say, guys, I don't... I don't know. Short of putting tents in backyards, or I don't know what you have to do. I just find this whole thing just so incredibly maddening. Not from an ideological, philosophical perspective, just from the maths. Mm. 1 + 1 = 2. Mm. It just is. 1 + 1 = 3. I, you can pretend it is. You can pretend it's not. You can simply choose not to do the maths and say, maths, I don't care about maths. It doesn't interest me. Except that's the only option. Am I completely bonkers mad here?
No, I mean, it's so... Everyone gets it. No, not a single person listening to this podcast doesn't get it. You know, like...
Right.
Supply and demand. Like, you learn it in year nine, right? It's one of the only sort of foundational core truths of economics that exists.
Yes,
like,
that's right.
Did you see the rant from... And I say rant in the appropriate sense of in a very kind way, from Max Chandler.
Alison, know that, mate. We're good ranters. We're right. They're okay with that.
From Max Chandler, Mather, one of the Greens pollies.
I did.
Just basically saying a third of people rent and they're on the edge. So the other stat there is that the rental vacancy is at, I think, all-time record lows. Like, it's 0.6. I can't even remember. It's so insanely low. Yeah. And anyone who's been through it, those who know, right?
Yeah.
My conspiratorial, not a conspiratorial, I guess my pessimistic take is that
cynical potentially.
The people who are feeling it are young or immigrant students.
Yeah.
Everyone else is fine. So it's sort of like from a political pressure standpoint, I'm just not hearing it from most of my constituents.
Yeah,
I'm just not, you know? And it's sort of there's a bunch of 20-year-old uni students who are up in arms about their rent. I was like, oh, why to do it tough? Yeah. It's just the pressure isn't there. And that's where Max's point, I think, was well made was that, yeah, well, it's still one in three people and they're getting angrier and angrier. And, you know, these people are getting older. They are the, you know, the more, they will be sort of the ones in charge in not that long. It's on an unsustainable path is the bottom line. So something's got to give. Something's got to give. And if you had any kind of capacity to look beyond an election cycle, what you should be doing is just, I'm less of a fan of sort of an entirely government-run program, but I think government should do everything it can to get out of the way to, but open up supply, ensure standards, and then the market will meet the need, right? It will. There's plenty of property developers out there that would love to build some more homes. I would be very careful about putting sort of conditions around that and what was required in terms of standards and space and access to infrastructure. Well, that's the other thing government should do, the infrastructure sort of adjustment to all of that. But whatever you're doing now is tinkering at the edges. Depressingly, everything today you hear on housing from politicians has come out of sort of some, you know, focus group. It sounds good. Yeah. There's a big, you'll get, you know, we'll build 10,000 houses. You go, oh, 10,000 houses. Until you actually look at the numbers and go, it's a drop in the ocean. You know, but it's just, it's, I can't see, to your point, I can't see anyone taking it seriously.
It's just, yeah.
Good for house prices. Yeah. I'll say that. I know, for the other two-thirds of people, you know.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Not that it means it supports house prices forever, but you put it on the positive side of the ledger.
Again, you talk about supply and demand, right? What happens when there's an imbalance of supply and demand? Where there's more demand than supply, prices tend to move upwards. That's kind of the way it goes.
So depressing.
Yeah.
There's nothing to say. I got nowhere to go with it other than, you know, we've just labored. We've flogged this horse to death so much, you know, and it's just.
That's why I'm kind of. I started by saying I don't really know what else we'd do with it other than.
Just lament it, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess the only other thing I would say, you know, and I don't know how ultimately effective it is, but like, have your voice heard at the next election, you know? I guess, or make it more known that this is an issue for you. It always feels so ineffectual, these grassroots movements, but I guess it's the best sort of option that you've kind of got if you want to be an agent for change in this. But it is a big cross to bear when you're just struggling to pay the rent that I've also got to take up an advocacy role for the bloody property, you know, debacle. I get frustrated because, again, having gone through it, it is an impossible situation, and there is nothing that's going to depress the human condition more than a lack of agency and powerlessness in that realm. And it really is that where a lot of people are at, as I said, so mainly younger people. It's just depressing.
It is. And as I said, it's not, this is one of those weird ones where it's not philosophical. I mean, you can argue about how you might solve it.
Yeah, sure.
The simple reality of it needs to be solved. Yeah. The math is the math.
It's not going away.
Right. I mean, you can argue about, you know, power sources, which we'll do in a second, and you can say, well, there's different thoughts and different approaches and different ideas, and maybe that works, maybe that doesn't work, and no one knows the future. Yeah. And, you know, there's times where you can simply say, I think this approach is better, or this monetary approach, this fiscal approach, this whatever. This one is just literally the maths of the number of people who want a house, the number of people who have a house, the number of people coming, the number of houses being built. Like, it's just A minus B equals C. There's no way to get around.
I mean, the other thing that gets me, because it's more visual, is that you just see this, and it's all over the news anyway. You don't have to be that observant. You know, the standard of housing, the standard of development. I was driving out somewhere the other day, and we passed one of these massive mega estates, and the most depressing thing, an ocean of black roofs a meter away from each other. Yeah. And the friend I was with sort of said, oh, who'd ever live there? And the response is people who have no bloody other choice.
Totally right.
That's who live there, right? Yep, like, what do you think? Like, there was a choice between Vaucluse and that? Like, you know,
exactly.
So even where we are, quote unquote, addressing the issue, we're doing it in a way that it's like, are we not just building future ghettos here? You know, and we're handing the people the keys to the, you know, massive debt servitude for decades and a massive maintenance bill and brutally real depreciation costs because of the crappiness of everything. It's just, I don't know.
It's where I really get, and this is, I don't want to go too far on a tangent here, but it's where I get back to my concerns about let's just build more houses, let's build more density or whatever else it is, right? I just think as a country, you start with, there's $27 million currently, right? Let's just, I'm not going to say close the borders. Let's just stop here for a second and say to the people who are still here, hey, where would you like to live? And how can you make that happen? And if people say, you know what I'd really love? I'd really love more high rise near the train station. Like, cool, let's build more of those. That'd be great. If they say, actually, I'd like an attached house with a backyard, cool. Let's not let it, the idea that this is what the YIMBY group really get up my nose. And if they're living rent free in my heads, well, congratulations, guys. At least it's rent free. the idea that what we should do to fix the housing crisis is build more high density because then we can move people in there. So, well, that's fine if they're just economic units of production, but they're real people with families and preferences. If they want to live there, I'm all for it. I'm not saying don't build more housing, but build them. If people want to build them, absolutely. If they are saying, you know what, I have the choice of a detached house or a unit, I choose the unit, please. Great. I love that. That's fantastic. If they're saying, you know what I really love? I want a big estate where I'm a meter from the neighbor and our eaves overlap. That's what I really want to live. And I'm happy to do that. Great. Fantastic. If it's like, actually, you know what I'd like? I'd like this or that or something else. And we say, no, no, you can't have that because we need to bring more people in. We need to build high rises so we can put them somewhere. That is just so incredibly stupidly frustrating and stupidly barefaced as a motivation. You know, yeah. As I said, I don't care where people want to live. But as a country, if you had this landmass and the population we've got, you'd start by saying, how could I make you happiest? Mm-hmm. And then if I can add to that by bringing more people in, let's do that.
Yeah.
And if it's 50 million people or 100 million people, then wonderful. I'm all for it. Mm-hmm. Really genuinely all for it. My biggest issue with the Big Australia stuff is the way we go about it, which is effectively that neoliberal, economically, whatever version of, let's just shove them in boxes and high rises because then we keep the infrastructure costs down and have more customers for our stuff.
Yeah.
And again, I'm an investor. Like, I like capitalism. It's fantastic. It's terrible, except it's the least worst of any other option we've got. So let's go with it and make it work. I just find that idea of we'll build, they will live wherever we tell them to live because we want them to live in this sort of place is just mind-blowingly maddening.
Yeah, and that's the other problem. Any supply-side response has, the imagination doesn't go beyond two-bedroom unit.
Yeah, that's right. Like, wherever we say you should live.
How do you raise a family of three kids in a two-bedroom unit? I mean, some people go, well, you've just got to work hard for it. And there's this expectation of this bloody property ladder where it's like, well, you buy that and then it goes up in value and then you flip into this and then someone else comes in and it's a lot of like, so you're telling me the entire housing policy is just based on an ever-inflating bubble? Is that the plan here? How about just build something? And I'm not saying that everyone deserves a swimming pool and a tennis court, but... It's not a big stretch. When previous generations could reasonably expect a three-bedroom brick house with a bit of a backyard.
For an average wage.
With a really average wage.
That is precisely my point. Yeah. You're absolutely spot on, mate. That's exactly my issue and exactly why I think it's one of those things we need to really work out. That's why we've got to start with, where do people want to live?
Yeah.
You know, you're in charge of Australia. The Australian population are your constituents. And they're saying, I would like an affordable whatever. And if it's an affordable two-bedroom unit, then great.
Yeah.
We should make as many of those and make them available to people as possible so they can have what they want.
Yep.
If you're 25 and single or you're in a room with someone and you want to do it in an inner city suburb in one of the major capital cities, great. Let's make sure people can do that. And then if, as you say, you've got three kids and you want to go, oh, you know what? I'd like a backyard, please, and maybe a pool or at least a pool nearby and a park nearby, and let's give you that.
Yep.
No, not give. Let's make sure that the economic settings allow for the maximization of, frankly, happiness. Like that's,
yeah.
You started talking about GDP. That's kind of where I get to is, why would you, who in their right mind, if you're actually running the country rather than running the economy, wouldn't say, let's try and make that happen. Let's try and make sure people don't feel like they are debt slaves for 30 years. Mm. Both people have to work. The kids don't see you because you've got to pay for the house that you have no option other than to buy in the place you'd rather not live.
Yep.
It's dystopian. It's just bizarre.
And of course, there's a massive spectrum between the little boxy unit and the five-bedroom palatial mansion.
Exactly.
Like,
yes.
There is an area near me which they've done so well where it's just like a series of townhouses. So, yeah, you could fit a lot more people on if it was a 50-story high-rise with shoeboxes full. But it's hell. You still, a lot more people are living there than if that was just, you know, a few quarter-acre blocks. And it's nice. You know, it's like there is, think a little bit outside of the box here, people. There are other options between only house and only unit, right? It doesn't have to be an all or nothing kind of thing. But again, full circle, no one's talking about any of this. No one's listening or taking action on any of it, of all of this. So I don't know what you do.
I feel better.
Yeah.
Mate, let's finish off just with This is the episode brought to us by Twitter, unfortunately, but so be it, because you know, often that's kind of my thoughts of the events of the week tend to just dribble out on Twitter during the week.
And then it's the digital town square, as they say. So
it really is. Well, let's go to Twitter. I posted on Twitter my electricity bill for the last quarter, whatever it was. And I sold back to the grid meaningfully more, about a third more power than I bought from the grid. So I sent, that must not really matter. It ended up being 1,500 kilowatt hours I bought. I sold back 2,000, right? So I sold back more than I bought. And yet, I still had a $600 electricity bill. And that's because the cost of buying electricity from the grid was 40 cents a kilowatt hour, and I got 6 cents for selling it back. Now, there's reasons for that. Time of day, if I'm generating solar power during the day, no one wants it because everyone's got enough, and so it's negative price and all that kind of stuff. So I get it, like, that's absolutely true. So I think it's important to, I'm not complaining about it. There's reasons why those numbers are different. Except, okay, this is not except I'm going to complain. This is except what it led me to think about is the impact on the grid. And this is, I'm not a scientist or engineer, right? We all know that very clearly. You're at least a scientist by trade. So that's the one you can go with. If you look at the pace of improvement in battery technology and the improvement in, so I got solar panels on my roof. They're 250 watt panels each one. And that was the best I could get when I put them on the roof 7.5 years ago. The new ones apparently are 440 kilowatts. So for the same roof space, I can produce, what's that, probably 80-ish% more power. Which is phenomenal, and probably for the same cost per panel. I haven't checked, but I would bet the cost is almost the same. Battery technology, I can get I put a Power One on the wall because I thought I was doing the right thing, and it's a terrible ROI, but you know, I felt it was the right thing to do. I get a Powerwall 2, which has double the capacity for the same price I paid then. Fast forward a few years, so I can't make a battery pay off yet. We have got to be between power generation from panels and the efficiency and storage capacity per kilowatt hour of batteries, at some point, it's not worth my while to use the grid other than as a backup for a couple of cloudy days in a row. And if you think about that at scale, this is the observation or the it's not even necessarily a new thought, but it just struck me that once we cross that tipping point, once it makes more sense for you and me and everybody else who's, by the way, not living in a unit, which is its other thing as an implication, but at some point, it's a no-brainer to actually take most of your demand off the grid and produce it locally. And that has phenomenal implications for power generation, for storage, for grid stability, for all sorts of things. And I don't know that I've necessarily got an answer, mate. I lean both ways, one of which is do your own power, be self-sufficient. The other is governments by privatizing electricity and not effectively swallowing the cost of the transition to renewables or whatever else we have will effectively undermine the grid, which makes it less stable. It makes the providers and the generators less profitable, or they have to put up their prices, which actually makes the cost for everyone else left on the grid much, much higher than they would be. And so we're going to end up with potentially energy haves and have-nots. Again, this is a social podcast, but if you kind of think through the implications here, the bottom line of the tweet was, I wouldn't invest in energy generation for love nor money. I wouldn't buy shares in AGL or Origin or anybody else. And I could be completely wrong about this, by the way. I'm not saying that I would short them. But if you think about the disruption that comes once we cross that generation tipping point and the storage tipping point, I said one more generation of batteries and I will effectively be able to use no power from the grid except in consecutive cloudy days. And my consumption from the grid will drop enormously.
Yep.
I don't know what my point is other than, as an investor, when those maths change, we're seeing serious, serious disruption, almost to the point of revolution in the industry. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch, but as I said, I wouldn't put my money anywhere near energy generation right now.
Yeah, it's definitely ripe for disruption, and it can go in a number of different ways. I think it's actually could potentially be the bank branch problem we were speaking of before. Like the reason why you would do it is if you've got the means to do it, because these technologies, while they'll make economic sense on a spreadsheet, the capital investment is upfront, and not everyone will have, particularly as we're still going on our journey down the cost curve, will have I don't know, what is it, 15, 20 grand for a full self-sustaining sort of system at their house, the one that can sort of see them through some cloudy days, etc. So you'll have this is the thorny problem, because the only reason central distribution works is at scale, everyone needs it. So we can put it down every street, we've got a customer. When all of a sudden your customers start switching off, you lose the scale advantages. The unit economics change very differently. So
it goes in reverse at some point, right?
Well, I'm building this massive, you know, network here to service Bob, and everyone else of Bob's neighbors is self-sufficient anymore.
So the cost of Bob goes through the roof.
Yep.
All the provision ends up being loss making.
Yep. Or he's got no choice and he's forced into it, and there's another challenge. Yeah. You know, there's the other little bit unrelated, but not very, is did you see the news throughout the week that Amazon is looking to power one of its data centers with a nuclear reactor?
Oh, I did not.
Yeah,
its own. That is remarkable.
No, I don't. I saw the headline. I clicked past it, and I've not been able to come back to it. So maybe
it wasn't a dream.
It wasn't fact checked. But they're talking about it, and so the part of the reason is that they need the reliability. Mm. I think what a lot of people miss, and not to change topics, but with the AI revolution, is that computationally it's much heavier. You know, the data centers you need to sort of serve Google ads and help, you know, search work and make sure that Zero is running is one thing. Large language models operating at scale and handling lots of queries, it's very, very energy kind of demanding. And they're all sort of building out for that kind of stuff. But the related point being is that when you've now got corporates solving that dependency problem, if that's the way to frame it, albeit in an entirely different way in this case, it again adds more and more pressure to the grid. So yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see how that all plays out. They have a huge, there is a huge advantage with incumbency and the sunk costs that they've got in a lot of the infrastructure. So I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but it could be the death of a thousand cuts that we're sort of living through.
I think that's the risk, mate. By the way, I just Googled that for you. Amazon bought a data center that is nuclear powered because the nuclear power station basically set up this data center and sold it to Amazon.
Okay.
So it literally sits right next to a nuclear power plant that already exists. I'm glad, as a shareholder, I'm glad Amazon isn't getting a nuclear power.
There you go. Okay.
That'd be a thing.
But that is those co-location decisions.
Yeah.
Another ingredient in the mix.
Exactly. I think that's absolutely true. Hey, mate, I think we've probably used up all the available time we have. The podcast has a certain capacity, as our listeners know, and we're about to hit that. We're about to hit our 64 kilobytes of storage, and at that point, apparently everything goes dark and it goes badly. But will you come back on Sunday?
Yes. I love the mailbag episode.
I have a mailbag question from a listener I think you will enjoy.
Ooh.
As much as it pains me.
I think I can guess. I'm looking forward to it already.
I think you probably can guess. If you do want to make sure you put a question in for the mailbag, just to help me out so they're not questions about things that Andrew likes and I don't, please hit us up. info@fool.com.au is the email address. Probably the easiest way for a big question. Otherwise, feel free to go at us on Twitter. You can follow Andrew @Sage_Simeon or @StrawmanInvest. You can get me, by the way, DM me the questions if you have any, @TMFScottP. I'm on Instagram as well at the same handle, and Facebook @Scott Phillips Money. Until Sunday, until certain questions that I'd rather not ask, but I am nothing if not here at the pleasure of our listeners. Full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.